Today's program has been brought to you by Underground Meats, an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. For more information, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation from Bushwick, Brooklyn, here at Roberta's, adjacent to Roberta's, where we can watch people start to have a delicious lunch about my favorite subject, which is in fact that lunch, or things related to that lunch. And today, we're going to be having that conversation with one of my favorite people. Many of you, if you are like me, have heard of Consumer Reports, and sometimes it conjures images of my dad looking for a new car, or probably, you know, buying my mother interested in a vacuum, and those were the days when you could only get that information in one publication that you subscribed to, and that was Consumer Reports. And I always loved it, long before top 10 lists and testing panels and tasting panels existed. There was Consumer Reports. But what you may not know is that behind that magazine is really a huge organization of advocacy and research, and that increasingly, although it's always been a topic of interest of theirs, but increasingly they've been a tremendous player in the food space, in some of the issues that you may have heard of or may not even get to, or perhaps you were reading the New York Times today and you saw an article about arsenic in rice. Well, the people who helped bring that information to the front of the media, to the attention of not just the media, but of lawmakers and policymakers, is the organization behind Consumer Reports, and that's the Consumers Union. And with us today is probably one of the most articulate and funny and charming and food-loving spokespeople of that organization, Urvashi Rangan. She's the executive director of the Food Safety and Sustainability Center at Consumers Union of Consumer Reports. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Mitchell. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, it's such a pleasure for me to find someone who not only knows all about the minutiae of the food advocacy world and the legislative world regarding food system issues, but also is such a tremendous food lover and appreciator of food. And if we have time, we'll talk about your kitchen up in North Manhattan. But let's start a little bit. Let's take a step back and explain to people the Consumers Union and Consumer Reports and a little bit about the process, about what you do.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Consumer Reports has actually been around since 1936, and we're a nonprofit organization. A lot of people don't know that. We don't take ads, we don't take commercial dollars, and that really enables us to sort of call it like it is and really be unbiased about it. We've actually been looking at food since 1936. Sure. It was in our first issue. We looked at strontium-90 in milk, which is a radioactive substance. And we've been taste testing since 1936 as well, as looking at food safety issues. I've been at Consumer Reports for about 15 years. Oh. And, you know, I have colleagues who have been there even 30 years in the food space. And we've been doing a lot of policy work in terms of watchdogging a lot of the systemic problems going on in food production, the constant use of antibiotics every day in animal production, for example. But we are now taking on food in a sort of bigger and better way. Mm. And part of our mission as a nonprofit group is to promote sustainability in the marketplace. And so we're not just about how to shop, but how to shop better and how to make better choices and promote sustainability in the marketplace. And when that comes to food, of course, there's how we sort of do it conventionally. And we know there are all sorts of innovative ways that people are finding to get to better and more sustainable food. And so educating people on what those options are and where they're really credible, sort of, and, you know, don't rely on natural, focus on organic and some of the other things is part of our bailiwick in educating people around shopping. But then we do a lot of investigative reports these days, and you brought up arsenic and rice, but looking at some of the more systemic problems going on in the food supply, especially where we don't have standards, where the government seems to be almost void at this point, and trying to make sure that we bring those to the surface, we have a public dialogue around those so that we can start to get some safeguards in place and bring the bottom up in terms of food safety.
So we'll get to some of those issues that are exciting you and that you're hoping to excite others about. Let's start with one that I know people who dismiss the concept of sustainability often begin with, and that is what does that mean for you from the perspective of Consumer Reports, but also for you personally? What when you say you're adding issues of sustainability, how are you defining those?
That's a great question, because some people think is sustainability just land stewardship, right, or management? For us, it's really about a holistic approach to food production, and it's really about producing food in a way where we're not depleting resources, we're not mining the crap out of a mountain to make fertilizers, mm-hmm, and that we're doing things in a way that takes into account where we're going to be in 10 years, in 20 years. Are we depleting something that we shouldn't be for our kids and for their kids later on? And really looking at a way to create a system that can be maintained over time without polluting the environment, without depleting natural resources, and in a way, a system that gets better over time. And I like to think of sustainability as an ideal. Mm-hmm. It's not a thing. And there's a spectrum of it. And there are practices we put in place that fall along that spectrum, and some are less than others, mm-hmm, but they all equally should be on the spectrum, mm-hmm, and moving toward a goal. And over time, as we learn more and more from a scientific perspective, from a political perspective, the bar for what is sustainable should be going up over time. It should be a moving, mm-hmm, thing. And so for me, that is sustainability, and it's an ideal, it's a goal that we should be striving for.
Your answer resonates with one of my favorite phrases, and of course I'll forget who said it, but it was they just thought sustainable was just not exciting. Sustainable ought to be the base, not a goal. That everything needs to be sustainable. Let's find something that's like aspirational that excites people. But to your point, it's a changing bar. It's one that always raises, and we can always be doing more and thinking about more creative and innovative ways.
I think so too, and I think that word is sort of a tongue twister. And you know, if we just want to strip it down, it's kind of a better and healthier food system,
right,
and a food system that's healthy. The food should be healthy, but the system itself and how we produce it ought to be healthy too.
So let's talk again, before we get into the meat of some of the particular issues you're working on, the organization consists of what? Researchers, lawyers, editorial writers? What are we talking about, this Consumer Union, Consumer Reports world?
We're quite a constellation, actually.
Floating around where? Westchester?
Yes, we are. Our headquarters are in Yonkers, New York. That's where our testing headquarters are. We have about 500 employees up at the headquarters and 100 more scattered around the nation. We have advocacy offices in Washington, D.C., in San Francisco, in Austin, Texas. We have our auto test track in East Haddam, Connecticut. So all of our auto testing goes on there. And we are quite an interesting group of people, a lot of right-brained and left-brained people clashing every day. But we are primarily scientists and engineers who do the testing work. And then we're an entire group of writers and reporters and investigative journalists who work with our scientists and our findings to get that out in the magazine and Consumer Reports. We have lawyers who both watch what we're doing in the magazine, but also lawyers that work on advocacy issues, pushing for better policy, mm-hmm, positions. We have a statistics department filled with PhDs that just analyze, mm-hmm, data. We have a national survey center. We can do national polls really at any time, and we do quite a bit of market research around that. Again, all of these filled with PhDs who do only that. Mm-hmm. And so we have market research. We have sensory department that does taste testing, but does other kind of sensory things as well, how well a vacuum pushes back and forth, for example. So, you know, every day is different at Consumer Reports,
sure,
and it is a really unique and interesting amalgam of people.
Okay, since I know we're going to get into some topics that people may react to or have questions about, I'll remind people listening, you can call us if you're listening live to ask your question at 718-497-2128. If you're listening to the podcast or to the archive, you can email us, or perhaps you prefer to write, as I do sometimes, at info@heritageradionetwork.org. You can also tweet us your questions at TasteMattersHRN. So when I first met you, it was actually at a presentation, I believe, at TEDx in Manhattan, when you were talking about labeling. And since then, we've heard that Whole Foods is going to label non-GMO products or whether or not they contain GMOs, I should say. So why don't we start there? Tell us a little bit about that situation, what's going on, and what you think the issues are people should know about.
Sure. You know, it's funny. I came to Consumer Reports 15 years ago to create criteria for rating labels and build a database to help educate people on that. So at greenerchoices.org, you can actually search for labels and find out what they mean and what they don't. And we felt we needed to make that information free, because it needed to be a public service. There was so much confusion in the marketplace, and how do we help consumers make decisions? And after 15 years of sort of staring at these labels in the marketplace, you know, the store aisles sort of scream at me. It is very, very difficult for somebody to tell by looking at a label and just looking at it whether it means something or not, whether it was verified or not, whether it has standards or not, right, and whether it means the same thing on everything they're looking at with that label.
Right.
And so a huge task for us is helping to educate people on what those labels mean and don't. I always find it fascinating, and in the TEDx talk we talked about it a little bit, how consumers think that natural means more than organic. They still do. And it's
amazing.
It's amazing. And, you know, that's part of our job, is to help dispel that myth. And we're sort of at that on a daily basis. And yet it's still so amazing, because the natural food industry and marketing things as natural has so much behind it in terms of power, that it can trump sometimes. Just from a design perspective, it can get people thinking that that means more. Mm-hmm. So we spend a lot of time educating people around those issues, but we also take it to the government, because we know that the long-term change has to come from some regulations, mm-hmm, and really creating a level playing field, so people can't get away with using ridiculous terms in the marketplace that don't have any meaning. Mm-hmm. And if there's one thing I wish I could do in my time at Consumer Reports, it would be to get rid of the natural label on the mm-hmm market, because credible labels can't compete effectively when the market is filled with what I like to call green noise, labels that don't make any sense, they don't have any meaning, and natural, free range, hypoallergenic, fragrance free, popular claims we see all the time, and yet all of those claims have very little meaning behind it.
In the GMO specific situation, I overheard people discussing, well, at least if we say something doesn't have it, maybe that's a good way to go. And I was recalling when labels started to say no cholesterol and things that never would have cholesterol, from the high yes end food perspective, every time I see cold pressed, which is a really meaningful word on extra virgin olive oil, except that extra virgin means cold pressed, and so there's nothing, no difference between one that says and one that doesn't. But what it makes me think of, and we come against this recently in our small foray into food systems work at the James Beard Foundation, is I'm not sure that only information is the answer. I mean, that's why the policy piece is so important, because there's tons of information. We have more information now about what we eat than ever before. On my phone, I can sit here and tell you, I could go to your website, I could do all that stuff. But there's also a saturation point among the consumers when no one's going to care.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And so, you know, how much marketing is too much marketing? How much green noise is too much noise to put into the marketplace? And you're absolutely right. And that's why we sort of have this two-pronged approach, mm-hmm, because we want to help people navigate today. So what can you do today? And sometimes you're right, it requires a lot of homework. In the meantime, we want to keep our finger right where it needs to be, and the spotlight, which is the Federal Trade Commission, the Food and Drug Administration, the USDA, all of our agencies that frankly are charged with preventing misleading and deceptive labeling in the marketplace,
right,
but they're not really doing it all
right
that well. In fact, they're sometimes accomplice to it. And so holding the mirror up and trying to get changes at that kind of level is incredibly important, and it's important for people to know they can get engaged in those kinds of things too and push for a better marketplace.
And I know this is probably hard to answer, maybe it's easy because of the work that you do. It's not necessarily unwillingness, but it's, I imagine, budget pressures and political pressures from large corporations that have vested interests and those sorts of things, or what prevents anyone, or is it just America is the land of freedom, and even though we agree as a culture that information is a necessary piece of democracy, that maybe we're not allowed to regulate it.
I think you're probably hitting on a lot of things that factor into it. But I think what people may find really interesting is that the Federal Trade Commission is a really interesting organization, in that one of their charges is to prevent deceptive business practices in the marketplace. So we've taken things to them. For example, a lot of municipalities can compost their municipal sludge waste as fertilizer, they can call it organic, which is legally prohibited in the organic program to use that, and they can sell it.
And it's full of antidepressant remnants and whatever.
Correct. Yeah, right. Sludge is quite a filthy thing. It's everything that goes down our drain and then pulled out of the water before we dump the water out. And so the cleaner the water, we always say, the dirtier the sludge. So there's metals, there's drugs, there's all sorts of things. Now, there is some treatment to that, but you can't treat out heavy metals and other things. And I guess, you know, we filed a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission saying, this is crazy. We've told the USDA this is bad. They say this isn't in their scope. Fertilizers are not in the scope of the National Organic Program, just food. So we say to the FTC, could you come in and regulate that product, because no one's doing it? And the Federal Trade Commission actually says, well, USDA has some kind of jurisdiction over organic, so we don't really want to get involved.
So there's nowhere to go.
So there's nowhere to go. Same with hypoallergenic and fragrance-free at the FDA. They have one toe in the water, but they have no standards and no verification for it. So if anyone filed a complaint, there's nothing to enforce against. And yet the FTC perceives that as being regulated by a friendly agency. Mm. And so they don't need to get involved. We would like to crack that, because that doesn't make any sense. That's not a good use of our taxpayer dollars. And in terms of really making this marketplace more truthful and transparent, we really need the Federal Trade Commission to step in.
While you're thinking about bureaucracy and sludge, we'll be right back. I'm talking to Urvashi Rangan about important things you should know.
This one's called Melted Magic by my friend Obesity on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Underground Meats is an American producer of handcrafted salami and cured meats in Madison, Wisconsin. They use small farms from southwest Wisconsin to source their meat. The animals are raised on pasture for their entire lives by farmers who care about animal welfare. While Underground Meats uses European traditions, they also use ingredients from the upper Midwest to try to create new types of salamis, experimenting with both ingredients and techniques. The salamis are made using heritage breeds, mostly red wattles, tamworths, berkshires, and mule foots. Try their award-winning cured pork shoulder and goat salami. To learn more and purchase products, visit shop.undergroundfoodcollective.org or stop by their butcher shop in Madison, Wisconsin. You know, HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization. If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'm speaking with Urvashi Rangan, who is the Executive Director of the Food Safety and Sustainability Center at Consumer Reports. What other radio station, I ask you, are you going to hear about red wattles and bluefoot pig sausages from the Upper Peninsula, and issues about Washington and food politics and the bureaucracy that sometimes gets in the way of processing municipal sludge? Let's switch the subject from labeling, though, and let's talk about some of the other issues that I know you're passionate about and that the organization has been working hard on, and the one I mentioned earlier that we discussed, arsenic in rice. What's going on there, and what are we in the middle of?
Well, as maybe some of the listeners know, over the last 18 months, we've done two big stories on arsenic, one in apple and grape juice, and the next one we did in rice. And these are two commodities that have been historically sort of high in arsenic levels when you look at the literature and the scientific literature, even according to the FDA data. We really wanted to get in there and figure out what was going on in terms of the rices and also rice products. I mean, it's a first food for kids. So many people eat rice. It's culturally such an important staple. And so we really wanted to kind of get in and tease out what was going on. And last year we published a pretty big investigative report on arsenic levels in rice and rice products. Part of our goal, too, was not only to highlight the problems with arsenic in rice and the differences that we're seeing and highlighting how maybe we can get to lower levels, because that's really our goal, is not to say don't eat rice, but really while we're trying to figure out what levels are appropriate, here's maybe how you can stem your consumption a little bit and what the government needs to do over time. We have arsenic standards for water because we know that inorganic arsenic is a known carcinogen. Why don't we have any in food? It doesn't make any sense.
Interesting.
And so because of that concern and because we were able to really do a very heavy-duty risk assessment on everything and all the products, we really felt like this was a great way to talk about arsenic in rice, the need for standards there, but why is it getting there in the first place? Mm-hmm. So looking at sort of the concentric circles around the problem, which are also problems. And so feeding poultry, for example, arsenic, we have arsenic drugs that are approved to be fed to poultry to prevent disease and speed their growth. It's used very similarly to the way low-level antibiotics are every day for animals.
Preventative, not symptomatic.
That's right, preventative, and for speeding growth,
right,
you know,
right.
And they never know why, but it seems to work, so they do it. We take their manures, which are laden with the arsenic, and we use them as fertilizers.
Right.
We also still have some arsenical pesticides that are still in use, and that's a very powerful industry. In fact, they have now pressured the government to start all over again with the risk assessment of arsenic, and that's another big controversy going on. So our goal in that was really multi-pronged to identify the problem, but also the causes behind the problem that people may not necessarily connect those dots.
Right, the real systems issues.
These are
systemic problems. And to that point, one of the pieces of information about the work on rice that was interesting is it doesn't matter if you buy your rice organic or Whole Foods or this producer. It's not about that. This is how it's growing, where it's growing, what's happened to the particular plot of land
exactly. That
rice has grown on.
That's right.
So there's no way to know otherwise than to have a test or have a regulation of some kind.
That's right. And that's why it's so important for our government to actually get a handle on this and make some determinations about the varieties that are grown, where they're grown, how they're grown, what we do while they're growing. All of those practices can actually, and variety, can impact how much that particular rice plant takes up. And there's great variability. That's, I think, as a scientist, the good news, because it suggests that there are ways to get to lower levels. We need to figure those out and codify them.
Right. Well, I think we have time perhaps for one more topic of interest. I know you've just come back from a National Organics meeting and have some information for us about fruit.
That's right. Last week was one of the twice a year meetings of the National Organic Standards Board, and the topic of the moment was the use of antibiotics on apples and pears. A lot of people may not know, and in fact, our polls show most consumers don't know that practice is going on.
I did not know before today, so.
And most people don't, and it's a terrible problem for the apple and pear industry, not just for organic, where an insidious disease called fire blight, which is caused by a bacteria, can infect inside the trees. It's sort of there all the time, dormant, but given the right weather conditions and other things, it can basically come to life and destroy an entire orchard in one fell swoop. Now, there's a couple things people should know. I mean, one, we as consumers support varieties that are very susceptible to fire blight. So we as consumers need to get very educated now around how we're contributing to the problem. The second thing is these fire blight bacteria are becoming resistant to the antibiotics that are being used. So there's a bit of a race to the bottom going on in terms of that use overall. That's a problem for the whole industry. The controversy in organic is no other organic food uses antibiotics. So should you be able to put an organic label on it? And the fact of the matter is it's been going on for a while, but we were adamant along with a number of other consumer groups that it needed to stop now and that we really needed to ramp up the development of alternatives, which now has taken place thanks to this controversy. And we really need our government to support those alternatives to transition those growers well. As of 2014, they will not be able to use tetracycline.
In organic apples and pears.
That's right.
And you believe it needs to stop, just to clarify, because of the same reason it the overuse in livestock is the problem it creates. It's not that it's going to hurt you to eat these apples and pears.
That's right. It is
a
misnomer.
There's a consequence.
That's right, Mitchell. Thank you for clarifying that. This isn't about eating an apple laden with antibiotics. That is not what's going on here. It's about creating reservoirs in the environment of resistant organisms to those antibiotics. And what people may not know is once you start that resistance, it's a little bit like lighting a fire of dynamite. It spreads. These organisms are living. They can actually swap genetic material with other like bacteria. They can actually create resistance to other antibiotics that are within the class. Sometimes they can hop classes. So any use, especially this low-pulsed use of antibiotics, is what exacerbates that problem. So whether it's in livestock or agriculture, using human medically important antibiotics like tetracycline and streptomycin is not a good idea.
Not a good idea. In the last few minutes we have, since this is a show ostensibly on taste, I wonder, since I know that you are a food lover of the highest order, I'm wondering if you could talk about what you see personally of some of the implications of this work on taste and food. You mentioned some species of apples that the market has produced. I imagine I'm going to say they're Red Delicious, since they must be the bane of all horrible things in the produce
world. Red Delicious
world
is actually pretty good when it comes to fire blight, oddly.
But the Gallas,
the Fujis.
Okay. But so, what are the implications for the pleasure of food in this work that you're doing that you see?
Well, I know. I mean, I think you're speaking to what motivates me to get up every day to do this work, because it can be a little depressing after time. But, you know, food variety in food, going to the green markets, fresh food, that's what it's all about, after all. I mean, people want things that taste really good. People like choice in the market. And sustainability gets people to that point. It also, I think, decentralizes our conversation on food. I don't want all my food produced at something that looks like an industrial plant. And the fact is we use a ton of ingredients that haven't been approved for safety. We've just sort of grandfathered them in as safe. But are they really safe? And unnecessary things. Do we need to dye food blue? I'm pretty sure we don't. And so trying to get a handle around what is necessary, but what is unnecessary, and how do we get back to basics for what good food really comes from? And to me, too, the variety of food, the sort of heritage varieties of things, for me personally, are what get me up every day and get me into food.
And we're so glad that they do.
Thank you.
We have a question from a listener, actually a series of questions. Some will be easier to answer in the couple of minutes we have left. This is from Ricky Lee, who's the author of The Food Lover's Guide to Orlando, so another food lover amongst us. She asks, first of all, is there going to be a food issue ever of Consumer Reports coming out soon? I mean, it's obviously in every issue, it sounds like, or at least on the minds.
You know, that's a great question, and I think as we get our food center up and going, we have a lot of food projects that we're going to be rolling out. So that's a real possibility, and thanks for that idea.
Sure. And then the sort of list that everyone wants, unsustainable foods we should avoid. Is there anything that you think is particularly just shouldn't be eaten? I don't know.
You know, highly processed foods for lots of reasons are problematic. We know they lead to increased obesity. You know, you just have to look at a school lunch in a lot of schools to know that we have a lot of issues with serving overly processed, overly fried foods, especially to our most vulnerable populations. I mean, our littlest kids, we're starting them off, it feels like, on the wrong foot.
Right.
And so I do think that that's where I'd begin my list. But I also like the idea of coming up with an unsustainable list. So thanks for that.
And lastly, Ricky asks, would you believe in a sustainable label since labeling is your thing, or is that just too much of a can of worms?
I'm not a big fan of the conglomerate label because I think there are so many aspects to sustainability that the bottom can start to drop out of one of those, and yet it's not clear to the consumer. And so people feel cheated when things start to slide back and they don't know about it. I like more discreet labels. I think we have a hard enough time getting discreet labels right. Like free range, it just shouldn't have to not mean anything. And so I think until we solve those problems, we just can't really talk about what a big conglomerate sustainability label looks like.
Well, Irvashi, I'm sure everyone now listening knows why I think you're one of the greatest advocates for food and flavor and a sustainable food system that I know personally. Thank you so much for coming here.
Thank you so much,
Mitchell. I hope you'll come back. And next week at 11 o'clock, we'll be talking to Sander Katz, who, if you have anything to do with fermentation or like fermented things, you will know is the author of The Art of Fermentation and a guru in your world. I will talk about the Underground Fermentation Festival I went to Sunday in Brooklyn, no doubt, and many things that grow, different types of organisms that we don't want bacteria to stop. In the meantime, between now and next Wednesday, why don't you take a Sharpie black marker and go in your cupboard and cross out every word time you see natural. Just cross that off that label and make Irvashi proud. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.